Hey folks, today's episode of Other People is brought to you by Bloomsbury, publisher of the debut memoir Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls by acclaimed literary essayist T. Keira Madden. Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls tells the raw and redemptive story of T. Keira Madden's coming of age and reckoning with desire as a queer biracial teenager amidst the fierce contradictions of Boca Raton, Florida. It is the official March pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls, available now from Bloomsbury. Okay.
You are not alone. You have found other people.
You and I have a friend in common.
Every stupid thing that a writer could do, I've done.
I think it's really beautiful.
Jesus, dude, what a struggle, you know?
It was incredible. It was like your head exploded seeing what was really there.
And now here's your host, Brad Listy.
Just one person at just one time.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome to the Other People podcast. I am Brad Listy. I'm in Los Angeles. Thanks for listening. It is good to be with you. I am thrilled to have Sam Lipsight on the program. This is the second time he's been on this show, but it was the first time that I've ever had a chance to sit down in a room with him in person and talk with him. He was here to celebrate the publication of his new novel, Hark, which is available now from Simon & Schuster. It is generating rave reviews. I believe that Sam Lipsight is one of our very finest writers. Certainly one of our very finest funny writers of depth, if I may characterize him as such. He is incredible on the page, and I kind of revere what he's able to do, and I'm just really excited to get to share this conversation with you guys. I should say, as a side note, that I wasn't sure if Sam and I had a good conversation until just recently when I listened to the playback. And the reason for that is that on the day that he came over, and I think we recorded in the late afternoon, his flight was delayed coming out of San Francisco, and then he kind of rushed over here to do the show before heading up to Skylight Books in Los Feliz for a reading. So we were working against the clock a little bit, but he made time, and he came over, and he was game. Now, as for my part, I had taken a microdose that day. A friend of mine, I was with a friend of mine earlier in the day, and you guys know, for people who have listened to this show, like, I've been fascinated with psychedelics for years, and I'm always talking about it. And I've read books about it. I read the Michael Pollan book. I read Tao Lin's book. I read Ayelet Waldman's book, which is all about microdosing and how it helped her alleviate her depression and so on and so forth. And so I'm fascinated by this. Plus, like, every coder in Silicon Valley is supposedly microdosing as a kind of biohacking performance enhancement thing. It's just hard not to be fascinated by it. I should say, too, that part of the appeal of microdosing is that it is sub-psychoactive, which is to say, you don't even feel it. It carries with it none of the normal attributes of the psychedelic experience. It's not like you're bugging out or anything like that. You take it and you don't even know. And yet it delivers these positive effects, supposedly. So there I am with my friend on the day that Sam Lipsight is due to come to my house, and I'm talking about this. And my friend, who is like one of the few authentic bohemian people that I know, like, everybody else is sort of pretending. Like, when I was a hippie, I was sort of like wearing a costume, but this guy's like an authentic bohemian. He's like the genuine article. And I'm telling him about Ayelet Waldman's book, I think it was. And he's like, you want a microdose? He's like, I'll give you a microdose. Like, he just had him on hand. And I was like, all right, yeah, let's do it. Like, I'm not going to feel it. Might as well. I'll take a microdose. I got to talk to Sam Lipsight. Maybe this will help me in the interview to be more lucid. Maybe it will deliver subtle but powerful effects that will enhance my performance as the host of this podcast. So I take this microdose. It's probably like right around, like, you know, just after lunch. And it starts to kick in. Like, I barely took any at all, but, you know, I have a very delicate system. I'm very sensitive to anything. I don't care what it is, whether it's weed or even booze at my age, and I think with my particular biochemistry and neurochemistry, I'm just particularly sensitive. The littlest bits will affect me. And I knew this. And yet, there I was. And so, you know, I don't want to overstate it. It's not like I was completely flipping out or anything, but when Sam showed up at my house, I was feeling weird. There was just like a, you know, there's a lot going on in my brain, or more than I was typically accustomed to. And I could feel like my eyes felt a little strange. I think my pupils were more dilated than normal. And there was like a kind of a sweatiness happening in my palms a little bit. It was just like the faintest hint of paranoia that was working on me. And I think, too, I was just anxious anyway because I revere Sam Lifsight. I'm like, oh my God, Sam Lifsight's coming to my house. I got to do this interview. Now, I'm always a little nervous when writers are coming over to my house, and especially when it's a writer whose work I have like such reverence for. So, you know, it's all this combination, I think, of like natural anxiety plus this microdose. And I have him over, and like as he's getting acclimated to my garage, I feel like I was sort of babbling. It's like talking about my day and talking about work and I don't even know what. And as I'm doing this, I'm thinking to myself, like, can he notice this? Is he aware of what's going on? that was kind of the mode that I was in throughout the entire interview, where I'm going through the motions. I'm trying to make sure I stay focused, but I'm having to work harder at it than I normally do. And I'm wondering, like, can he tell? That was kind of it. I was convinced that Sam Lifsight could tell that I was low-key shrooming during our interview, but would not have that particular understanding of my circumstances and would just think that I was weird. So the good news is I have listened to the playback and the interview is fine. It's actually better than fine. It's a great talk. I feel like we got a good one. You know, everything that was happening for me psychologically, and I don't think came out, at least, in a egregious way in my duties as host. Though, for longtime listeners, I mean, you guys tell me. I don't know if you'll notice. There are like a couple of moments where I'm sort of spacey, but I think overall, I kind of pulled it off. And Sam was great. So, you know, we go through the process of the interview. Then Sam has to leave to get to his reading at Skylight Books. I shake his hand. I thank him. He walks out the door. And I'm like, holy shit. Like, I can't believe I did that. I was, like, kind of kicking myself. I was like, I can't believe I was shrooming while talking to Sam Lifsight for this podcast. What kind of moron am I? And what, you know, why am I such a weakling? I barely took any. So, you know, that was it. Or at least that was it for the day. I kind of put a pin in it. I took the dog for a walk. Probably ate some dinner. And then I went to bed eventually. And I woke up the next day. And as is my nature, I continued to sort of obsess about it. Like, wow. That was strange. I can't believe I did that. I wonder if Sam could tell. I wonder if Sam thinks I'm weird. I wonder if Sam feels bad about the entire experience. I wonder if Sam thinks that I'm unprofessional or stupid. And then, like, you know, the spiral continued to the point where I was like, you know what? I gotta just email him. Gotta just email Sam and explain the situation to him. He's an understanding human being. He'll probably think it's, funny. Or at least I hope he will. And so I just laid it out. I wrote this lengthy email to Sam Lifsight where I explained the entire situation. Where I was like, "Dear Sam, thank you so thank you so much for coming over. It was such a pleasure to meet you. I have to confess that I was low-key shrooming during our interview. And I hit send. I sent it. And then, you know, you do something like that, and then you sort of wait. And, you know, the hours go by. I'm just, like, trying to put it out of my mind. Like, listen, you came clean. You did what you had to do. This guy probably thinks, you know, you're weird, and now he knows why. And as these things go, you know, like, I didn't know. Would he write back? Maybe he would just be like, whoa. Delete. But no, he wrote back the next day, and he was incredibly gracious and was essentially laughing, and also told me that he had no idea and that he thought the interview went well. And I think he's right. I genuinely think he's right. I listened to the playback. I was like, oh, this is great. We sound good. With a couple of exceptions where I'm sort of dazed, but I don't know. I appreciate Sam's patience and generosity with me. I appreciate him making time to be here with me in my afflicted state and to have a good conversation. And I'm pleased to share that with you right now. Here he is, folks. This is Sam Lipsyte. His new novel, One More Time, is called Hark. It is out there now from Simon & Schuster. This is Sam Lipsyte.
I guess what I'm always looking for is a container to hold it. I'm looking, and that can be the story, or that can be a character. That's, oh, it's a way in. It's a kind of access into it. And so then what can hold all of this? And in this case, it was this idea of this spiritual practice and these kind of charismatic leader and some people who are projecting their fears and desires onto him. I'm describing the new book, Hark. But I think I'm always looking for, I got all this stuff I want to put in, but what's going to hold it? And so I'm always looking for that. So the container is the first thing.
And the container in this case was the character?
In this case, it was the dynamic between this leader and these followers and this idea of mental archery, which was so preposterous. I just found it was so stupid that I thought, you know, here's a challenge to write a whole novel around something this silly.
And to to actually build that.
Yeah.
Spend time.
To build that world.
I felt like that, like at some points I was like, is he channeling Tom Cruise? Maybe it was the name Kate.
Yeah.
And he kept using, like, he kept, you know, keeps using the name. Is that at all?
I think I'm of a generation that is channeling Tom Cruise most of the time.
Me too. That's why I recognized it. And so, you know, another thing that strikes me about you and your work is that, like I was kind of saying, like, it's angry. You can feel anger in the comedy, but angry in all the right ways. So I guess, like, bravo for having good instincts.
Oh, thanks.
And, like, a good moral sense. But that's the way that I feel. It's like, oh, like, thank God someone...
Well, there's that fine line between, you know, righteous and self-righteous, and you kind of want to be on the right side of that, I think.
How do you guard against it? Do you have to scrub it out in the edit?
Well, yeah. I mean, sometimes things, you go over the top, or sometimes you... I do so much revision. I always say I really dislike writing. I like rewriting. I really love having something to play with. Getting that first draft is the torture.
How do you work? Like, in terms of just like the my listeners love this stuff. It's like the day to day. What's your schedule?
Well, because I teach full time, I don't get those big chunks of writing time during the school year. So a lot of the heavy lifting is happening in maybe the 4 months of the summer, that long academic break. And so those are the days when I'm getting up and putting in 6-7 hours a day and just really going for it. And then during the school year, I'm doing a lot more of the editing and more of the, you know, playing with this chapter and playing with that one. But also there are days when nothing happens. But a teacher told me this a long time ago, and I always remember it. Even if you're just going to do 15 or 20 minutes, it's important because the danger is to say, oh, well, I don't have a lot of time today, so I won't do any writing. And you kind of lose touch with your project. But if you can just sit down and move a couple commas around and just read what you've been writing for the last few days, even if it's 10, 15 minutes, you're keeping the current alive between the work and your brain. And I think that's really important, especially during those stretches when I'm not getting the big writing hours in.
But it seems like kind of a good little system. You know, you have like the academic year where you don't have as much time, but you're absorbing, building up, and then you get to that summer.
I think that's it is a good system. Yeah, I mean, maybe it's better to have some time where you can't plunge all the way in. I mean, that's what you're saying, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something to that. I mean, like, there's a lot of time. I mean, I think everyone who writes knows that there's a lot of writing that happens unconsciously before you're even at the keyboard. But you do still have to do the work of transferring that to the to the screen.
So unfortunate.
It's a little of both. The other thing is I mean, writers all work differently, and so there's no one system, but I don't really start with a big plan. I sort of feel it out and I let it develop and I follow it and I go sometimes just sentence by sentence and see where these utterances lead me.
So no outline.
So I think that once – if I'm writing a novel, once I'm kind of into it, I'll start by taking notes about where things can go. And, you know, I might scribble down on a piece of paper, you know, for tomorrow's writing session. You know, he goes to the store or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But nothing really big, and I don't have some complete outline. That first draft is just about discovering what I'm writing.
Okay. So you're in the summer – like the heavy writing phase.
Yeah.
And you're in first draft and you're sort of just like finger painting in the dark. Like there's no pre-planned. How much permission do you give yourself in that phase to be messy?
Well, I mean, there's an interesting tension there because I give myself total permission to be messy, and it's important to make a lot of mistakes and throw things away. But I'm also a very around this stuff, not in life in general, but around this stuff, very anal. And so I always want to fix everything right away and make everything neat and right and land correctly.
I got some of that.
And so I feel that maybe over the years I've accepted this as a productive tension between these two impulses, one to just let it all fly and the other is to like fix it immediately. And if I find the right balance between those two things, I'm kind of moving sideways, but I get momentum and I can go.
Well, but it seems like a healthy tension because that and like a necessary one, because if you're too permissive, then it's just a mess.
Right.
And if you're too, I got to fix it, then you don't let yourself.
Then you become a perfectionist and you can't get to somewhere interesting. Yet.
And I think, too, because you work in a silly vein, you know, comedically, like you have to let yourself be silly. And probably entertain, I would imagine, some like jokes that don't work. And
yeah. Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's, you know, the work of a sit-down comic, you know, you're cracking jokes and some work and some don't. But the thing is you have to – the silliness also demands a very serious attention and precision, because if it's off at all, it really sucks.
Right.
And so that's to me always the line I'm riding is if I don't get this to work perfectly
– How do you know?
Well, you just know. I mean, I mean, maybe you don't know because sometimes people say this sucks. But
I mean, do you have like a reader who's like, it's good? Or do you just have like an inner, you know, barometer?
Well, first you have to trust your, you know, the person inside you who sits or the one sitting on your shoulder saying, you know, that's good, that's not good.
Right.
Although, but I also have people who read my work and give me feedback.
Like a trusted, same people for every book, or does it vary?
Well, it's a few people, but I mean, my wife is the first line of defense, so I give her everything. And
if it doesn't get past her,
right,
then it doesn't go into the book.
but then, you know, I have a few other people that I show things to. But then also, this book, I started it in 2012, and I was working on it for a long time. So I was able to really see what could stand the test of time and what didn't. Hmm. So I could pull things out that just maybe seemed funny at one point, and not just funny, but poignant, because the book is, you know, it's in the comic vein, but of course, there are all sorts of – there's the gamut of human experience and feeling in it, or I try to have that. And so, you know, is this really funny? Is this really moving? Is this – you know, or did it just seem so at the time? That's a lot of it.
So 2012, that's interesting because you like the bulk of work on this book was done pre-Trump.
Yeah.
And yet it seems like, I guess with that knowledge, kind of predictive.
Well, I mean, I don't think it was predictive. I think all the stuff that I mean, Trump is sort of the culmination of a lot of stuff that was happening for a long time.
I know, but not everybody's picking up on that.
Right. But I mean, a lot of the stuff that, you know, we are talking about, whether it's climate change or, you know, the wars we've been fighting or rising inequality, all those things, they were in the air long before Trump. You know, Trump just was like the absurd exclamation point on it all. But I think that I was interested in those things in the book, and those were the sources of the comedy and the anger in the book were those kinds of things, and they predated Trump. I mean, not to say Trump hasn't moved it all into some extra awful place, but it's not as though that everything was perfect in this country,
right?
And then we elected Trump.
Right. Well, I mean, like, it's like, you know, you hear people say, he's not the disease. He's like a symptom.
Exactly. I mean, I was saying this last night to some people. I said, if you run headlong off a cliff, don't blame the cliff. And Trump is the cliff.
Right.
Like, well, why did we run? Why did we do that? That's the question.
Well, and I was just going to say, like, what is the disease?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, he's a symptom of the disease. Okay. But, like, is the disease greed? Is it hatred? Is it all of the above? Is it ignorance? Like, it feels like this big soup.
Yeah,
of complicated human failing.
It is. It's just this complicated swirl. You're right. And I think there's hate, and I think there's also fear and people feeling like there's not going to be enough for them. There's like scarcity.
Yeah,
there's a lot of things.
But I mean, like, not entirely unfounded.
Well, no, because if you look at the numbers, the American. And I'm not here to talk about my new book on the economy, but, you know.
Oh, wait, what?
Wages have stagnated for the last 30 years. I mean, there are reasons that this stuff festered the way it did.
Yeah. I mean, it's
the health care, all of it. You know.
So a theme in
So I just want you to know that I'm running for president.
This is your big news. We're breaking news here on the Other People podcast. So I want to talk to you about success, like the notion of it and like how you define it. I'm interested in this. Like, what does that even mean to actually succeed as a human being? I mean, I know what the conventional definition is. I certainly know what like the American definition seems to be, but I'm not satisfied with it.
No. I mean, I think that I wrestle with this a lot in my books.
Yeah, I know.
Or the characters do. Just this idea that gets handed to us about what success looks like, and a lot of it seems pretty materialistic, and a lot of it seems hinging on appearances. And I think that a lot of people are realizing that they've been sold a kind of a bill of goods on that stuff. And I mean, for me, being a successful human it has to do with the way I am with my family and my friends, and just the kind of person I am, and the kind of energy I give off, and the ways I can be of use and not just be someone who is taking.
Right. Well, and I feel...
And that's success as opposed to having some yacht or something.
Well, yeah, having stuff, getting some sort of status. I mean, I guess you need some of that in life. Like, you can't get your book published unless you do... You got to jump through certain
hoops. You have to jump through some hoops to get to it. The place where they will publish your book or give you a job teaching. And I mean, that's all true. And so there are markers of success in one's life, but that's not really how I think ultimately as you get older, you're not measuring yourself that way.
Well, and I think too, like more thought, I think we'd all be better off if we, you know, I'm speaking kind of collectively, put more thought into the consequences of the work that we do. We were kind of talking about that before we came on, but it's like, that's always on my mind. I just want to be non-toxic.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like making literature and teaching writing and literature is about as good as you can get. I mean, at least in terms of my imagination and the kinds of things I'm interested in. And I think all too often in kind of our corporate driven society, you know, you wind up in jobs that can easily compromise you, even if you have better intentions.
Oh, I think that happens all the time. And even teaching, and there are ways that you can be compromised. I don't think anyone really – the problem is that under this system, no one really escapes. You know, and the only people that escape are people who are so independently wealthy that they don't have to do anything.
Right.
But if you have to work for a living, you're somehow participating in the problem, whether you want to or not. But then you have to try to find other ways to compensate for that, I guess.
Well, that's what I've been thinking like lately. I'm like, you know, these people with these incredible fortunes, and they're still doing stuff. It's like, just go on vacation. You did it. Like, stop. I got to say, too, when it comes to mental archery, which is like...
And, of course, just to finish, I mean, if you do have that fortune, you're still participating because your money is doing things, you know.
Yeah, just give it away. Do some good with it. But mental archery and sort of new age spirituality, is this something you fall prey to at all? Because I feel like I'm kind of the perfect mark for mental archery. I'm ready to sign up.
Yeah, I think we got to form a group and really get it going.
Are you – but I feel like you're sort of – I feel like you're too smart for a lot of that stuff.
Well, right? I think I was interested. I didn't want to just make fun of that sort of thing, but I could, because so many people I care about, and myself included, are kind of always wondering, is there some answer? Is there something that we can – some practice that will deliver me from this – pain.
It's horrible suffering.
Yeah. Just the pain of getting up in the morning. But so I think so many people I know are, you know, try this or try that or mindfulness stuff, yoga, whatever it is.
I've got a Buddha
meditation.
On my shelf.
Yeah, we all dabble and we all or I mean not I won't speak for everyone, but I know a lot of people. And so I was interested in kind of coming up obviously with an absurd version of it. And also, it's a very – I mean, as the book goes on, it becomes the very American story of some people founding a practice that may be useful or may not be, but then others swoop in to monetize it and make a profit and try to build an empire on it.
Dietz.
Yeah, Dietz.
I like that character. Your character names are good.
Thanks.
Yeah, you know, it's like it feels like – and your book addresses this with all of the political strife, climate problems, economic. There is a kind of a rubber meets the road moment that is rapidly closing in on us in terms of like human suffering, damage inflicted by humanity on our planet and on each other and on other species. And like what to do about it. Like it feels to me like we're going to have to make revolutionary changes. Is that too strong?
Well, no, something's got to give.
Right.
Yeah. It's a lot of it's beyond my understanding, but it seems that there has to be some major political shift and some major decision about, you know, who we're going to be as a species or like. It's not going to be pretty.
Do you have faith we can make those changes?
I don't know. I mean, I sometimes hear very optimistic people say, well, humans have done amazing things in the past. And so perhaps we can. But first we got to get rid of this president.
No kidding.
And then
like
we'll see.
Sooner, like fast.
Yeah.
Like I'm totally, you know, everyone's always like Mueller. And I'm like, Mueller needs to hurry up.
I know. He's...
It's like work faster, Bob.
It feels like he's dragging his feet. Like, you know, is he just taking really long coffee breaks or...
I don't think he can afford it. I think we need to... look, there are a million indictments and convictions. It's not like he's done nothing.
Oh, of course. I'm just kidding.
But it does feel like a race against the clock.
And I mean, everyone's now acting as though it's a foregone conclusion that Trump would lose the next election. And I just the other day I was thinking that's a really dangerous thought.
Yeah.
We're all going to get complacent again.
Or if there's even free and fair elections to begin with.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that he would considering all that has happened to the people in his orbit, how many indictments and convictions and pleas and flips, like all this. I mean, this is an absurdity. Any other president would have been gone, you know, last year.
Yeah.
The fact that he's even projecting any kind of confidence that 2020 is a thing should scare the shit out of all of us and should make us pay very careful attention to the integrity of our elections. Because if you're that confident about it, like what's going on? I'm suspicious.
Well, we already know that there, you know, fishy stuff happens, so.
Yeah, too much. Did you watch, are you into cults? Did you watch any, like, because I watch all these documentaries about cults and cult leaders and the dynamics of, like, you know.
Yeah, I used to be really into cults. I mean, not myself.
You spent some time in a cult?
I never spent my time in a cult, but I was always in, when I was a kid, I loved movies about cults and read books, you know, about various cults. And I guess my first novel, The Subject Steve, sort of had a cult in it. So, you know, it's something I've been toying with as a theme for a long time. I realize that it's a great way to bring a lot of disparate characters together under one roof. If they're all in a cult, then you don't have to explain why they're all there together.
Right. Got a great reason to be hanging out.
Yeah. But I just, I've always been interested in the dynamic between a certain kind of leader and others, and the kind of what that charisma does and the way people project themselves onto a figure like that. Because the thing about Hark in this book is, you know, where he's not conventionally developed as a character the way the others are. He's kind of this cipher in the middle of it all. And so, like, you don't know what kind of toothpaste he likes. In the same way, like, if you think of, you know, famous figures, like, you know, from history, that those aren't the kinds of details you really know about them. Whereas a character in a novel, you kind of get all these fine-grained details about. So I was interested in exploring that in this book. And I was remembering the other day, when I was a kid, I was really freaked out by this movie I saw. I think it was Canadian, but it was called Ticket to Heaven, and it was about...
it already sounds terrifying.
And it was about Moonies, I think. And they had to sell the flowers on the side of the road.
Uh-huh.
And I think there's a really terrifying deprogramming scene in it. But I just remember as a kid being freaked out because they're all hunched in the van about to go out onto the street to sell the flowers for the money for the cult. And they're just chanting, "Bring in the money, stamp out Satan. Bring in the money, stamp out Satan." And that's etched in my mind.
I mean, it's like, yeah, you're not even trying to fool anybody at that point. Yeah, it's like, you know,
and that's what I'm trying to do with my work, to bring in the money and to stamp out Satan.
Just the basic dynamic of people in a cult or a cult-like group just looking at each other and agreeing that the bullshit, they've just agreed that this bullshit is true.
Right. But we do it on a large scale in the more accepted religions, and we do it in our political system in some way. I mean, there are right. other places where we all sort of agree on a reality. So I think that's one of the reasons we are fascinated by cults, is because they're not that different from some of the other institutions that just seem normal to us.
Right. Well, I mean, we're in Los Angeles. Like, yeah. Every time I drive past the Scientology Center.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm just like, wow. And it's normalized. And I'm like, do we realize how crazy this is?
I mean, aren't they still illegal in Germany or something?
Yeah. I mean, not without good reason.
Right.
But yet here, it's just like, you know, it's part of the furniture. Did you think about that at all? Is that something you've ever done reading about or been fascinated
by? Well, I've read some of that Lawrence Wright stuff, that book. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's great – that didn't really play into this book, but that's a fascinating story.
And then what about – you said you're kind of a sit-down comedian. Did you ever try stand-up?
I thought about it when I was younger, and I just realized that I didn't really want to get up in front of an audience and do that. But it was more that the way I was funny – I realized worked on a page more than it did. A stand-up is doing a lot of stuff with language, but also there's a lot of body stuff. There's facial stuff. There's vocal inflection. There are all these things that make a great stand-up comedian. And all I was really interested in was the language part. So it felt more right to – and then, I mean, I wanted to write fiction. I wasn't just wanting to write jokes. I was turned on as a young writer and reader by writers that I thought were hysterically funny, but also very deep and moving. And
like who?
Barry Hanna would be one. Grace Paley, Thomas McGuane, Stanley Elkin. And these are writers who I think, you know, could get to the whole gamut of human experience, but also be screamingly funny on the page when it called for it.
Yeah.
And so that was a big revelation for me, because before then I was a reader and I liked books, but I always thought that they had to be serious. And I always thought that nothing, it couldn't be good and funny. Like there was something wrong with it if it was funny. Then it was just like a bathroom joke book or something.
Yeah.
And so the discovery that literature could be deep and funny at the same time was a big moment for me.
Absolutely. And did you ever try like open mics or anything like that?
No, I never tried anything.
Okay.
Like that. It was just all in my mind. I had a stand-up routine in my mind maybe, but yeah. I had a solid five in my fantasy. And then I became, you know, I was friendly with some comics. So I, you know, I saw what the real thing was, and that made me understand that I'd made the right decision.
I was going to say.
Yeah.
There's kind of a recurring motif in your book where a father is looking at his kids and being like, my God, you've inherited a doomed world.
Yeah.
And that hit home with me so hard. Do you have kids?
Yeah, I do.
So you feel that too?
Oh, yeah.
And like that guilt about like, did we do the right thing by having kids in this fucked up world?
Yeah, I mean, I don't, it comes and goes, that feeling, but it's still always there on some level.
Yeah. It's just a shame that like, it's like the stakes are that high. And that bringing children into the world should, I don't know, it should be like a beautiful, happy thing, like without question.
Yeah, and it is, but you know, it mostly is, but this thing lingers, this idea. And I don't know if it's different for us than it was. I mean, other people have brought children into the world during dark times, but maybe it's just the sense that like, there's this apocalyptic feeling in the air, like it's ending. Not like it's bad,
right?
But it's that it's ending, and yeah. That's what is really strange about it. And is it? What if you were? I was thinking about if you lived in, you know, Europe in 999 A.D. or something, and you know your local priest had told you that the world was going to end by religious prophecy, you know, within the year. Well, what did that feel like? Was that a similar feeling? And if you had kids, were you like, oh, what did I do? Like,
yeah.
Like next year, the sky's going to open up and everything's going to end. And I feel bad about bringing this lovely child into the world.
I mean, possibly. That's the thing. Like, you know, I think like anybody who has kids, you're like, that's the greatest thing. Like, I don't regret it at all.
Of course not. Yeah.
And then at the same time, you worry about your children's future. And when I look to the future, I'm not like, I don't think dispositionally apocalyptic.
I don't either.
You know, I'm like pretty like, I think I'm kind of optimistic, a little bit fatalist, you know, a little bit of fatalism, but it just seems like best case scenario, it's going to be a very tumultuous situation with the climate. And I don't know. I don't think like, I guess my concern is you can't put the genie back in the bottle. Like it's done.
And maybe that's the feeling. Yeah.
Maybe you can mitigate like some of the worst parts of it if we get our act together super fast and really do dramatic things. But even with that, it sounds like from what I'm reading, it's still going to be like a lot of displacement and resource problems. And
yeah. And then you just imagine your children sort of in the middle of that chaos. And
thanks,
Dad. I hope they can. Yeah.
Fuck. Yeah, I worry. My son has disabilities, and I'm just like I got to make so much money.
Yeah,
I got to just like I got to buy him an island. It's like this feeling I have, and maybe it'll be better than I'm thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I think it will be. My grandfather lived to be about 101, and you know, he was like born in like 1904 maybe, and you know, he had these older brothers who built this crystal radio set, and he remembered sitting around the table listening to the SOS distress signals from the Titanic as it was going down. And so, and you know, he lived through a couple world wars and the Depression and all this stuff. And at the end of his life, he just said, you know, listen, nothing is nothing is as bad or as good as you think it's going to be. So maybe.
There's some wisdom in that,
yeah,
though.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. Maybe we're taking it all too seriously. And, you know, but like you said, it just feels like.
Well, because we have the scientists saying that it's over, you know, that it's done, like yeah. you just said. So that's what's different. There's not that, well, if we just do this and do that and rise up and change. We're kind of being told that that window passed, but I don't know if it really did or not.
Well, and what about like geoengineering?
Yeah.
You know, isn't that like, what if like you got to like somehow refreeze the polar ice caps or I don't even know how you would do that. This kind of thing is like way beyond the scope of my imagination.
Well, I got these specs here I wanted to show you.
Have you solved this? Please tell me you've got this under
That's
control.
That's the next book, How to Refreeze the Polar Ice Caps. Moving out of fiction just into straight engineering, really.
Another thing that I was thinking with regard to Hark is just this, like, this kind of idea that like a comedic figure rising to a level of, and I guess Trump is sort of this way, though. He's not at all intentionally comedic. He doesn't even laugh.
No. It's the true sign of a psychopath, I guess.
Yeah. But I think that like there is maybe an openness or like the things have gotten so absurd that like a comedic figure I could see resonating with people in a serious way.
Yeah.
You know, like, do you ever have that sense? Like, wow, like I could, like, I feel like it happened in Italy where a comedian.
Oh, right. He's like the guy who became a politician.
Yeah. But it's like, but it was also, what was the guy? The Berlusconi.
Yeah.
Who's very much like the Italian Trump.
Trump. Yeah.
And in the aftermath of him, essentially, there was like this opening where things had gotten so goofy that the comedian came in and just started, you know, I feel like we're sort of ready for that in America, like psychologically. I'm not saying I want it to happen. But do you ever feel like that?
Like some kind of comic figure could become a leader.
Like some kind of comic figure could start a GoFundMe and start doing right. viral videos. And
well, it's not going to be Louis C.K. That's for sure.
No. but I don't know. I'm just like, I think at this point, like it's like open season. If there's anything like Trump did that is interesting, or I don't know. But one of the things that he changed is I feel like he changed the rules of what's acceptable from a candidate. It's like you don't have to pay your dues anymore. I feel like those lessons have been learned by the system now. And like,
yeah, I mean, we were building towards it. You know, we had Ronald Reagan, who was an actor, and but at least he did some time as a governor before. And then we had, you know, the weird Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I feel like the groundwork was laid for this for years.
That's right.
Wasn't Jesse Ventura and all that stuff. So that, you know, that cartoon, the cartoonization of politics was going on for a long time. I'm wondering if like we can get, if the next president is going to work very hard to get back to the kind of formality and serious procedural, attitude and be a very kind of dry persona.
It almost, because what do they say? Like David Axelrod used to say that like every presidency is like a correction to the last one. So like you had George Bush who was like.
So like what we're going to want is like a technocrat.
Yeah. We're going to want somebody who like knows how to do government.
And is very drab and kind of, you know.
So who's that?
I don't know.
Who's the drabbest in the field? It's going to be, I always say it's like a clown car. There's going to be so many people up for it. So, so are you working on another book right now? Like, or do you finish a book and then do the tour and then start after that? Or do you always have multiple projects going?
I've been working on I've written a few stories, but nothing I would call a book. It's always a great idea to have another project going before your newest thing comes out. So you're not kind of just checking the internet for see what's going on with the book that you have out, but you have something else to.
Do you read reviews?
Focus on. Sometimes, yeah. I mean, it depends.
Just like, just people tell you, or are you just like, okay, I know this is coming, and I'm going to go to the New York Times, or I'm going to go to wherever, and
sometimes they'll say, oh, this review came in, and you know, a friend will tell me, and sometimes I'll find it, and then sometimes I'll read it. And sometimes I can just tell by the headline that I don't want to read it.
That's good. That's the beauty of a headline.
Yeah.
But there was a thing on LitHub just like came out today. I don't know if you heard of it, but it was basically they do this feature where it's like, you know, a book comes out and it polarizes critics and they'll do like a back and forth. And I started to think, like, I think emotionally, you know, the first obvious thought is like, well, of course you want everybody to love it and applaud for it. That's what we want as artists, is you want to put something out into the world. You want everybody to be like, this is great. But then I started to think about it more and I was like, is that really the ideal scenario? Like when you put something out, isn't a polarized response the ideal?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there are two things. Intellectually, I want the polarized response, and I totally agree with that. And as it turns out, I almost always do get the polarized response. I get, he's amazing, and burn him.
Nothing in the middle.
Nothing in the middle. But emotionally, you want, of course, as you just said earlier, it still would be great if everybody loved you. But that you understand there are almost kind of four categories. There's the smart good review, and there's the not that smart good review, and then there's the smart bad review, and then the not that smart bad review. And the thing that's really annoying are negative reviews that are dumb. Because then you just feel someone is, you know, was not qualified to really review the book and is now blocking, in a way, the others from reaching it. Because people read – there's so much to read and see and listen to that people read reviews. They're looking for a reason to not read a book or not see a movie.
Well, this is how I feel.
And so that's what angers me, is when someone who really doesn't know what they're talking about and has no business reviewing a novel becomes that gatekeeper.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I also find myself getting frustrated. I don't know if this would fall into the dumb good review category, but over and over again, I read book reviews and it's like an effusive review for the most part. And it goes like 75%. The first 75% of the review is all the reasons that it's a great book that you should read. And then there's always that bit at the end where it's like, but.
And I stick it in at the very end.
At the very end. And I'm just like, don't do this to me. Like, not that you can't offer your criticism, but just the format feels lazy. I don't know. Something about it frustrates me.
And then the whole idea is so that you're supposed to finish the review feeling like, well, I guess there's something wrong with it, so I shouldn't read it.
Yeah.
And what was the point of the review?
The point of that end is like, it feels like the reviewer like covering bases.
Yeah.
It's like, well, just in case like I'm wrong for liking this, I'm going to say that there are some bad things about it just so I can feel like I don't know. It feels
just
cheap.
I don't want you to think I'm a sap.
Right. But I think like you said, there's so many different, not just books, but so much media vying for our attention in the culture that we're living in. That if you really love a book, just be effusive.
Yeah.
We need effusive.
And or have criticism, but say, you know what, this book, I don't mind a review that says, there are elements that I didn't like as much, or I was disappointed in this part of it, but it gave me a lot of pleasure in these other ways. And I think that that's a fair review.
Maybe the sequencing is what I'm bitching about. It's like just intersperse your criticism. Sure. Don't just save it up for the end.
It's like this big setup, yeah.
So, and then what about writing for the screen?
Well, I haven't done much of that. I wrote a TV pilot years ago that HBO bought but never produced.
What was it called?
It was called People City. And they were kind of – I think they were choosing between it and this other show that went nowhere called Girls.
Terrible choice.
Yeah.
What do these people know?
They don't know their business. Anyway, but it was an interesting experience. And then I haven't really done. I guess years ago I just for fun wrote a screenplay or two. And lately I've been playing around with something with a friend of mine who's a director. But we'll see. I love movies. I watch a lot of films and I watch some TV too. But
what kind of movies do you like? Is there like a genre that you gravitate towards?
I like things that are – I mean, I guess I like movies that are kind of like the books I like, that are kind of strange and funny and coming at things from an interesting angle. But then I will also sit and watch some dumb shit for for hours if I'm on the couch. And
have you seen The Masked Singer? My wife.
Oh, I've heard about this show. Yeah.
It's like you're sitting there for a half an hour waiting to find out that Terry Bradshaw is wearing like a donkey costume.
Right,
like,
exactly. No, when I saw the promo for that, I just thought that is genius. That's people are going to just sit there and watch this show.
They love it. And yeah. There's like that moment where you're like, this is the dumbest fucking thing ever. And then you sit there and you watch it and you're like, I totally can't stop watching this.
I can see the addiction there.
I feel that way about American Ninja Warrior. That's another one of these dumb shows where I'm just like, I fucking love it. It's like just people doing an obstacle course.
I don't know if I've seen that one. I don't watch a lot of the reality ones for some reason. I never really got.
I watch a lot of documentary.
Yeah.
Do you watch documentaries?
Not that much sometimes.
I just finished watching like a 2-part Elvis documentary.
Oh, what was that about?
Yeah, just Elvis Presley.
Just like any special aspect of the Elvis story?
It was like the HBO documentary, okay. You know, and so it was trying to be, I think, comprehensive, but I still feel like I didn't get to know him. It was just like, what was it? Like, you know, I know he's supposed like the king of rock and roll, and you have a certain respect and reverence for what he had created, but I never like sparked the music the way that some people do.
Yeah, I mean, I had this weird, when I was in kindergarten, I had this classmate who for some reason was really into Elvis, and he made me sit in his room and listen to Elvis records, and I think I pretended to be into it for a little while, but I mean, we're not of a generation that would have been into Elvis anyway.
No, but I think it's like the whole he's the king, and I wanted to like, I have some desire to like understand where, you know,
why someone would be the king,
music history. I had a friend in college who was like deep into Elvis and like would, you know, like put on the costume and stuff at parties. And I was just like, what are you doing? But yeah, I watch a lot of docs and,
Have you read White Noise, the DeLillo book? So you remember the whole Hitler Elvis showdown between the two professors?
No, this is how bad my memory is.
It's kind of a funny scene.
What was it?
Well, the narrator, I guess, is the, you know, director of Hitler studies at the university, right. And then he's giving this lecture, and then one of his colleagues comes in and they kind of trade off facts about Hitler and Elvis in this kind of glorious dance of
sounds good
biographical analysis. It's really a great scene.
That's an excellent novel. I'm ashamed that I can't remember like key details, but it's been a long time. I remember the line of station wagons. The opening.
It's worth rereading.
Yeah, that's another, like, he's another writer who's, like, eerily predictive and, you know, sort of knows everything.
He really, that guy's a genius.
Have you ever met him?
I have, yeah.
See, what's he like? Because he seems like, he's like an unknowable figure in a good way. He doesn't really do a lot of press, and he's not.
No, he's from the old, like, silence, exile, cunning.
Right.
School, the James Joyce thing. But he's actually a very, you know, nice guy. I mean, that sounds very mundane, but I remember I once was talking to him, and I was kind of all in a state because he's such a hero, and I was, you know, really nervous and having a hard time keeping my shit together while I was talking to him. And he was just being, you know, pleasant. And you know, he asked me, like, what I was working on, and I told him, but I was all over the place. And then
45 minutes later,
and I asked him what he was working on. I think he was working on that book, Falling Man at the time. But, he said something like, well, Sam, I've been working on this book, and it's really been this great experience lately. And I remember he said, it's just curling out of my typewriter like a beast right now. And I was so nervous that I just said, I just blurted, well, I look forward to curling up with your beast.
That's one of those ones where, like, after it, like, that night,
and he just gave me this little look and then walked off to talk to somebody else.
Check, please.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, that's, I mean, you know, the thing, too, that's, I think, intimidating about him is that there's the, like, the wicked smart, he's incredibly intelligent, but there's also, like, not a ton of humor in that work. There's some.
Oh, actually, I find it really funny. I think he's really funny, but it's super dry.
I mean, I guess White Noise is
is very funny. Some of it's not as funny, but especially some of those earlier books, like Great Jones Street's really funny.
Right.
End Zone's really funny.
What's the one with the big magnum opus? The one about the artist and I read the thing and I can't fucking remember.
You mean Underworld?
Yeah.
Or, yeah.
Yeah, that one's not that funny.
That's not that funny. But yeah. The earlier ones, Libra's not that funny, but White Noise is really funny. And some of those early, even Ratner's Star, which is this weird one about math. That
is meth?
Math.
Oh.
Not one of the most read of his, but I like that one a lot.
Yeah, I've read like Libra, Underworld, and White Noise.
But like End Zone is the one about the college football players, and that's hilarious. And
well, he's great at what I mean, like working in a satirical mode. It's really hard to do and to sustain and to.
I guess I don't think of it that way because if I did, then I would psych myself out. I don't sit down and say I'm about to write a blistering satire of American culture because I think I wouldn't know where to begin.
Do you sit down to write comedically, or is the comedy just an outgrowth of?
I think the comedy is part of my filter. So I'm going to describe things in that way because that's kind of one of my storytelling modes. It's not the only one, but it's a major one, and it drives things. But I think that it's part of how I see things, and so it's that people always ask: do you like stick the comedy in later? And it's like, no, it's just kind of how I receive the world and see it. And both, I find it both funny and sad at the same time, all the time. And so that's what ends up being on the page.
Yeah. Do you ever get, have you ever experienced like huge creative block or anything like that in your life?
Yeah. I mean, I have periods when I can't write well, or I just can't write, or it feels mostly I'm mostly going to force myself to write something, but it'll just feel awful and be awful. And I think there are two, well, probably more than two, but I've experienced a couple different ways of being blocked. And one is, I don't know, what I want to write about. I don't know what to do. There's nothing. And it's kind of like the well is empty, and that's more, I just need time to fill it up, to be not trying to write so much. I had this great teacher in college, Edmund White, the great writer, and he's like, oh, Sam, it's because of the whole Protestant work ethic thing that American writers, they write too much because they think they're supposed to write every day.
I like that attitude. Where did you go to school? I think
I went to Brown for college.
Okay.
And but then there's another, I guess, with the block thing, the other kind is you can almost sense where you want to be, but you can't get there. And so you're always trying to find the way in. And so you're kind of, it's like circling in a building, trying to find the door into it, like a huge building, because inside is all the stuff you want to write about, but you don't know how to get in. And so that's another kind of, and that just takes actually writing your way to the entrance.
What about your reading habits? I imagine like working in academia, you're like, I have no shortage of reading time because you're reading all your students' work.
Yeah.
But reading for pleasure, like, do you get burned out to the point where it's hard to even find time to read for pleasure, or do you?
Well, I get to the point where it's hard to find time. I'm always eager to do it. My greatest feeling is I'm reading this book because I want to, not because, and sometimes if I'm teaching a seminar, I get to teach books that I like, and so that's fun. But it's nice to sometimes read a book and you're not reviewing it, you're not teaching it, you're not giving someone feedback on it. You're just going to, that's a nice feeling. I'm just going to read this and whatever stays with me, and it'll be an experience.
It's the best feeling in the world to have a book where it's like you cannot wait to get back to it.
Yeah.
I love that. Is it easy for you to find those books?
No. I mean, I think it's like anything else. There are a lot of great books out there, but then there are a lot of books that aren't that great, or that aren't
for you. Like I feel like this increasing pickiness as I get older, and I don't know if it's just it's the way of aging, or if there's something wrong with me. But it's like I'm trying to find. I always say the instruction manual, but just that book that's like speaking to me at that particular moment in my life, and it's like every once in a while I dial it up, but a lot of times, like, I'm just like going through books, like searching for something, and I don't even know how to quite define it.
Yeah, I know the feeling. For me, I'm asking myself, does this person listen to himself or herself to, as a writer? Can you tell, is this person just seeing the sentences as these kind of vehicles for a story, or are they trying to do something interesting with this language? Are they hearing themselves sing, basically? That's one question. And then, you know, is there something that they're saying about life that is going to help me live and die? I mean, it gets that stark on some level. But
that's how I feel. Yeah. Like, that's what I mean by the instruction manual, you know? Like, I really just want...
Like, what the problem is life, and do you have something to say about it? Do you have something to offer? So, I mean, people ask me, you know, what do you read for just escape? And I don't read for escape. I watch TV for escape.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way.
But if I'm going to read, I don't want to read something that's, you know, I don't read escapist, whatever, work. I mean, I like the fact that you can escape into a book. And I like entering new worlds and stuff, but not stuff that just – I mean, I know people who read a book a day and they don't remember what it was because it was just, you know, like tissue paper.
Right. Yeah. I can't do that.
Yeah.
I'm sort of envious of people who can just like literally pick up anything. Like, oh, yeah, I read that. And I'm like, what? You did? Like, for me, it's much more serious to me. Maybe I need to lighten up.
Yeah. Maybe we both need to lighten up.
I feel like you're doing really good work in the world.
Well,
and,
thank you, Brad.
I feel like you're one of the funniest writers working today. And it's just a real pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, I appreciate that.
And you said you have some stories noodling. There's not another novel in the works.
No, I mean, I'll get something going at some point. But for now, I'm just taking it slow.
Taking it slow. Trying to, like, hopefully weather whatever storm we're in.
Yeah.
Do you have any sense of the ending for this particular, like, historical moment that we're in?
They all seem so frightening.
25th Amendment. Quiet.
I was on the plane today and I was reading this article in Harper's about our relationship to China, the U.S. relationship to China. And all these, a large percentage of experts predict a war between the U.S. and China within the next 50 years. I mean, can you imagine that?
Oh, my God. Like, but what would it even look like? This is the thing, is that land war seems like sort of passe at this point.
Yeah.
Like, really inefficient. So then it's like information war, which is what we're living in right now.
No, I mean, they're talking about military soldiers fighting. I mean, seems to me that like, to even have that conversation.
Well, I'm reading stuff on Twitter, which, you know, you have to put an asterisk next to it. Too much stuff, but it's like all of these big, huge fentanyl busts that we're seeing in the news, you know, that really they don't make huge headlines because there's so many other crises, but it's like, you know, the smallest, tiniest little amount of this powder can drop a human dead.
Well, that's a very scary.
It feels like chemical warfare.
Yeah.
But like sneak attack and like people are addicted and just, you know, it's coming in from China. And so I'm like, well, what is that? Like,
yeah.
It feels like so much of this stuff, I guess what I'm getting at is that when it comes to state versus state bad action, it's one thing if it's like visible and we can see it and it's like, oh, they're soldiers, you know, like
right.
They're bad guys, there's airplanes, like, but so much of this stuff feels invisible. And so you don't even know what's happening until it's happened. And that kind of feels like what happened in 2016.
It's like The Masked Singer, really.
And then at the end, it's fucking Terry Bradshaw. Who knew? Well, I appreciate the time and wish you well on the rest of your tour. Are you done? Is this it? L.A.'s the last stop or you got more?
I got more. I'm going next week. I'll be in Tulsa and Austin and Oxford, Mississippi.
Well, good luck. Safe travels. I hope you don't have to spend like 2 hours on a tarmac again.
Thank you.
Dude, I mean, these L.A. rains.
I got some reading done. It was fun.
Okay, good. Well, it's good to see you.
Great to see you.
All right. That is Sam Lipsight. There he is. Sam Lipsight. His new novel is called Hark. It is out there now from Simon & Schuster. Go get your copy. Sam has a Facebook page. I don't believe he has a website. I could be wrong. You can track him down online using your favorite search engine. Sam Lipsight, the novel, one last time, is called Hark. Thanks to Kill Rockstars and the band Stereo Total for the theme song music. Thank you to Tiger in My Tank for the interstitial music. The Other People podcast is listener supported. Your support makes a difference. If you want to support the program, you can do so at patreon.com/otherpplpod.
That is patreon.com/otherpplpod. If you would like to email me, if you want to send me a letter, let me know what you think of the program, if you want to tell me a story, whatever it is, the address is letters@otherppl.com. Don't forget, this podcast has its own official app. The Other People with Brad Listy app is available for free wherever you get your apps. Go get the app. It's free. Thanks again to Bloomsbury and the debut memoir, Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls by T. Kira Madden, the official March pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. If you want to sign up for the Nervous Breakdown Book Club, you can do that at thenervousbreakdown.com. So, comedy of errors. What else can I tell you? That's my life. That's everybody's life, is it not? Is it not just a series of, you know, deep humiliations interspersed with moments of brief joy and neutral tedium? I don't know what to tell you. Just got to get through it. Try to enjoy it one moment at a time. Coming up on the podcast on Wednesday is a conversation I had with Pam Houston. She's got a new book out called Deep Creek. The subtitle is Finding Hope in the High Country. Pam Houston coming up on Wednesday right here on the Other People podcast. All right? All right. Okay. Okay.